Caleb Milne, who's going to tell us how we will proceed through a kind of conjuring and complicated system. So thank you so much for being here.
Hello, I'm Caleb Milne, senior English creative writing major, very proud and humble editor. I'd firstly like to thank, that did kind of sound like an oxymoron, I guess. Proud of my staff. I'd just like to take a couple minutes to like thank everybody, because this kind of effort is a community thing. I'd firstly like to thank you, Marianne Salmon, faculty advisor. I'd like to thank Jim Harms, Marcia Bissett, Sarah Monroe, the English department, etc. I would like to thank the bench as well. Calliope had a lot of help from the bench, local artist collective. Jeans Monday at 7. Just come check them out. I would also like to thank my editors, Allison Ekman, fiction editor, Mitchell Glazier, poetry editor, Alexandra Vaughn, nonfiction editor. A lot of hard work has been put into this year's issue. I'd also like to thank the readers. There's a whole list of them in the back of the journal that you can check out. And Senvio Publishing, which is also the same publisher who does the Poetry Foundation. It's kind of a cool little thing, big deal. So here's how we're going to proceed with this. If you are a published prose writer in the room, can you just kind of like raise your hand real fast? Real big, real high. Okay, so we got 4. Cool. Published poet in the room? Cool. Okay, so we're going to have the so we're going to start at the beginning. With Christopher Henry, and we'll probably just go through the journal mostly chronologically and then break it up with a prose writer who will give us like a little taste of their writing. So if you would please welcome Christopher Henry.
Thank you. After losing a son, a poem. She walked the carnival's cracked concrete path, following a blonde-haired boy, the elastic bands of his pants bunched up above light-up sneakers. He danced like a blown dandelion to the amplified organ grinder music. In trance, she stepped, her sequined heel in the remains of a funnel cake. Strawberry goo kissed her open toe. She knelt down with a used napkin to clean it, and the boy floated past the flashbulbs on the Ferris wheel and vanished into deep fire smoke from the lemonade trailer's window. Thank you.
Okay, and next, I think I already said his name, but I'd like to give a huge shout out to Patrick Bailey. He put so much work into this. The font in the journal is designed by him. He's also got a really lovely poem in there. If I could ask you to come read that for us now. Patrick Bailey.
Bonjour. This one's called Let's Eat. Poets still in eighth grade and McDonald's have yet to be beat. I like burnt bananas. Something about the way bitterness sticks to the teeth and sweet coats the tongue. Then again, I also like whiskey. Like a new leather sofa after granddad's had his cigarette. These kids gotta learn what's good. Shittle Shaddle, what's that sound like? Sounds like me being mad in the morning to find an empty pack of cigarettes. Wake up, baby. Eggs and bakey. There's a pan on the stove and a pack of sugar next to the eggs. Make these kids something good to eat. I love you. I don't want to see you in the morning. Stuck somewhere between staring at a yellow silted spring and a bird in a box's chirp. It's a broken main running down the street. Paint, once down the sink, now sits on the road and walking through a shop door. When I remember, I can't remember what's good. I ought to call Audrey. A locket would be there when I'm not. But what about all those summer nights fearful of the fall? I held her and put in her all my hopes and dreams and gave her everything I had to give because it was right to do so. I used to think a certain amount of distance was good for a relationship. Let the fire burn brighter when you brought the flames finally together. But what about when distance takes more than it should? When I see the girl I love become a candle near its end, burnt too long, left alone. I eat her ashes. I take her inside of me where it's warm. I kiss her and say, "Hello, my dear. I love you, as I always have. I am your locket. You are my picture."
Okay, and up next, Shayna Burleson. If you just want to read a couple minutes from each piece. Yeah.
Shayna Burleson.
This is a piece called Dare. I have to run when I hit that trail. Every time, without fail, my feet soak up the freshness and the wildness from the pine needles and moss and take off like two leaping does. There's something contagious about the way the skinny trail twists unexpectedly through the pines and scarlet-leafed blueberry bushes. It suddenly breaks out on a wide rock shelf, revealing a stunning view, then plunges back under the pines. A rustic wooden boardwalk breaches a swampy area bristling with tiny cranberry plants and glossy red berries. A sudden turn. The trail kinks around a lone beach, its yellow leaves mirroring the sun dancing on the pine needles below. Dad is behind me on the trail and sees me catch my foot on a root. "Like a mountain goat, Shanna, you gotta pick up your feet when you run." He dances lightly from side to side down a rocky patch of trail, his feet beating a random staccato on the firm ground between the rocks. I try it. I don't trip once for the rest of the afternoon. Like a mountain goat. The phrase is typical of Dad. He's a big man with a bigger heart, a grizzly bear, the leader of my family, and a daredevil. As a college student in the 80s, he hiked Yosemite Park with his brother Dave, grinning for the camera with his legs swinging over the edge of Half Dome, the ground more than a vertical mile below, and his overgrown sandy hair streaming out from under his 49ers cap. He climbed up Yosemite Falls and balanced along the jumbled rocks at its crest, and climbed to the top of an ancient sequoia in a thunderstorm, riding it back and forth like an upside-down pendulum. He rode a Harley-Davidson and skydived out of an airplane. He's my childhood hero. And then I'll skip to my other one, which is called Justin. Dad was crying. I had never seen him cry before. I didn't even know dads could cry. In fact, who wasn't crying? Justin was gone. "Let me tell you about my friend. He was descended from the grandfather of all giants," he told us. Giant Grummer was his great-great-great, let me put it simply. He was tall. And strong, too. He could carry my little brother around on his shoulders like he was a nymph fly. He had red windblown hair, lively hazel eyes, and an almost constant grin. When he spoke with us kids, he would bend over slightly, fold his long arms, lower his head, tilt it to one side, and listen. I don't even know what we talked about. Tree climbing? Bird songs?
How to keep your balance during a cartwheel, fried eggs. It didn't really matter to Justin. One morning when I was 9, Mom sent me to deliver something down the street. As I passed by the office building where Justin worked, my mind stuck on something. On a coffee cart inside the conference room, I knew there was a small white dish of sugar cubes. I had seen them before. They were on the second shelf. I needed one. I could feel the hard, sweet corners chafing against the roof of my mouth, finally dissolving into nothingness as I crunched the last few crystals between my molars. I was like an addict with a $100 bill on the second day in rehab, vacillating, wobbling on the doorstep of indecision. Then the door opened and Justin strode out and saw me. "What's up, Shanna?" He bent down to listen. Without embarrassment, I told Justin. Putting an index finger to his lips, he went back into the conference room. Later, I was told that there was a business meeting underway. A second later, he emerged out the door again, his huge hand cradling at least 5 or 6 sugar cubes. Grinning, he slipped several into my waiting hand and dropped the rest into his mouth. Then he was on his way, and I continued on mine. I wasn't surprised at all. I could trust him with anything. I pushed myself along unsteadily, my feet sliding out from under me too quickly, beating a choppy and lopsided rhythm on the bumpy ice of the pond. Last year it had frozen quickly on a calm night, resulting in a clear, glassy surface, and ice skating had seemed easy. This year was different, I thought, as my arms suddenly flailed out, the tip of my skate blade having caught in an air bubble. I slid to a stop on my rear, the cold finally managing to sink through the previously impenetrable layers Mom had swaddled me in before she let me outside. As I watched the other skaters gliding and whirling, I unwrapped my home-knitted scarf from around my hot face and neck, sighing. A sudden shower of ice shavings rained down as Justin hockey stopped in front of me. He helped me up, and taking one end of the scarf in his mittened hands, he slowly started across the ice. I was pulled along, wobbling and jerking like a drunken snowman. I held on, especially as Justin sped up, his long legs swooping gracefully over the ice as we shot across the pond. When I realized I had lasted for 30 seconds without falling, I let myself relax and enjoy the ride. At the far edge of the pond, we looped around in a wide arc, and Justin shouted, "Let go!" To my surprise, my hands complied, and I found myself sailing across the ice, completely steady and straight. For the rest of the afternoon, we skated this way. Pull and drag, release and glide. Pull and drag, release and glide. Over and over. And when I trudged home satisfied across the frosty brown grass that evening, my feet feeling like wooden posts in my boots, I knew I could skate.
Thank you, Shana. Up next, I'm going to ask Jordan Carter to come read us her poem.
Hey, you guys. This year I was a reader for Calliope, and it was a pleasure to read all of the submissions. And I know that this journal is great because, not because I had a hand in selecting the pieces, but I got to read all of them, and I know that we picked the best of the best, so if you're in here, congratulations, you did a really great job. My poem is on page 13. It's called Opening and Delivering, and it's about my grandparents. Desert spell of black hair, lines she drew around her eyes, molded him stealer, stealer, stolen, stole, 22 Luger from brother blood. Bare lady legs across bench seat, blouse open under blistering sun, dark skin spitting sweat, baby on her raisined breast. 2 tires blown from heat, dragging dust, drifting, the heat of her insides opening and delivering. Thank you.
Thank you, Jordan. Is Jess Reed here? No? Okay. Up next, I'm going to ask Meat to come up and read us a couple of poems. Everybody give it up for James Madison Jarrett.
Hi, everyone. Sometimes I go by me. I'm published in this as J.M. Jarrett because I go by so many different names. So I just decided to go with the initials. It's easiest that way. I was also a reader this year, and there was a lot of really great poetry. So I was excited. I'm really, really thrilled with what the final product is here. Am I just reading my one poem, Caleb? Or both of them? Okay. Okay, so this one's called November. I unzipped her gut. He stood watching. We gasped when milk leaked from her teats, but found no fawn in her belly. Then, sighing like the steam rising from her and my hands, I handed him the heart. Take a bite. I did my first time. That day, my older brother pulled a trigger, and I taught him how to gut a deer. Years earlier, alone, I stood in a field with no willing mentor, in my socks, shouldering a rifle, naive innovation, and a knack for evil. The first to collect horns, fun was rubbing his nose in my accomplishments. What I mean is that I had something to teach and was proud to help. Socks make less noise than boots, and only idiots hunt by trying to stalk. We both thought the other was Grandma's favorite, mutually jealous and eager to win. We were competitive and contrary. As kids, I refused to acknowledge I was younger than him, and we never got along, so when he wanted my help, I enjoyed every moment of ignorance. I feigned contempt. He nervously laughed, but reached for the heart. I waved his hands away, laughing, and lost interest in the prank. He would have done it. I saw it in his eyes. I was just happy we were together. This one is titled, You Could Never Pass for a Socialite. Twilight zone, street lamps, new black vans, broken fourth wall, then left at 6th Street, the party, will be seated presently, searching myself in bathroom mirrors, Riesling, crab dip, prime rib, tiramisu, more too sweet wine, just like grandma made, blackberry eyes, lemon rind skin. And pick me out of that ditch if you believe in breaking hearts. I look a bit like Jesus, in that I don't at all. Sadly, the key to humor is pain. Killers, tinfoil, and Marlboro menthols, Winston Black's American spirits, and Appalachian traditions. We spent all night drowning, thirst in a cloud of Luna moths, laughing hysterically drunk, throwing our pocket knives into the decking boards. Carhartt and Ariat's, sky's blue elegance, smoldering stars, honeysuckle dependency, white clover, alfalfa, Timothy. Too many summer horses and we don't see enough of you. Around here anymore, it's retirees and dead-end country roads. Guilty children don't forget. What are the name of the restaurants? They stay out too late and sometimes, why are you dressing differently? Excuse themselves from acting decently. Who's that girl we don't get to meet? As if there was no one watching them, wring their wrists and hide their future. Will you please take care of yourself? Thank you.
Okay, and I think we have about 4 more readers to go. This next part of the reading is kind of exciting. You've heard a bunch of different readers talk about how they were part of the process, etc. But we did get quite a lot of submissions, and these next 3 writers published multiple pieces in both genres, which is quite a feat. So first up, I'd like to welcome Lindsay Terlikowski.
I'm a bit confused about how.
You just do you.
Okay. Sure. Baltimore on page 3. Okay. The air smells of fish and the wind is whipping hair into faces. A performer holds 6 knives and slings them into the air, smiling, dodging, and catching them again. Paddle boats shaped like dragons line the dark harbor with paint-chipped snarls. A small roller coaster roars with bells and rides in bent circles all night. I'm just going to skip the next poem. Is that okay? Okay. And then go to... the in-between on page 47. Okay. At the age of 20, my closest cousin and neighbor became pregnant 3 months after meeting a boy. She announced this on a crisp day at the end of January. This and the fact that she would be marrying him 2 weeks later on Valentine's Day. Sitting in a dented plastic chair at the reception, the wind having blown my ears numb and deaf, I leaned to my left, asking my 60-year-old grandmother to repeat what she had just said. I said, she began and then paused. Her eyes turned teary and lingered on my cousin sitting across the room, who looked beautiful and who had refused to have a first dance with her husband. I said not to worry. This can happen to you too. Growing up in Lincoln County, West Virginia, I imagine, is like growing up anywhere else in the world, except that when it's you growing up there, it feels different, just like everywhere else in the world. My family has been low income as long as we've been alive. This was the same for my neighbors and the neighbors of my neighbors and the neighbors of everyone I knew. Most of the kids hated their families for it. They demanded nice clothes with bejeweled pockets to cover their asses and $100 price tags, and their parents somehow made it happen. My parents knew those sparkling jeans were uncomfortable when sitting and refused, not that I ever asked. Instead, they sent me to school with lunches my mom packed the night before, complete with sandwiches stuffed with square, pale pink ham and chocolate puddings with plastic spoons. My ass was covered. Like most people, I grew up resenting the place I called home. Everyone was racist, and publicly so. During a 4th of July parade, all the American flags were replaced with Confederate ones. Everyone said nigger, and they said it hard, lingering on the R. Heaven was a place for Baptist, white, straight men and their wives, if the women were willing to hush up. We married early, had kids early, and died early. Usually it was the cancer. I can remember giving a speech during my graduation, looking out onto a field of sinking chairs in the mud, seeing all the male and some female classmates spitting their chewing tobacco into empty water bottles they carried out with them. I spoke about achievement and beginnings, pausing and smiling as my voice reverberated. And I told God, privately, that I would saw off both my legs and never take a sip of alcohol again if only he would let me die somewhere other than up a holler in Lincoln County.
Okay, and up next, Victor Warnock.
On the page here. This poem's called Dialogue. Too brief work break, hour 8, 4 to go. Everything outside a white fresh snowfall. I'm just starting to wonder where all the color went when a ladybug lands mid-shirt, stark against my starched black frock. I palm her, strawberry red, burning. She speeds to fingertop, shuffles red back, a testing of wings or a nod, before disappearing in wing beat, cold. Still, the thought of that brings warmth, laughter, like when we'd get drunk and argue God. This next poem's called The Bronx Zoo, Summer When I Was 15. Lowland gorilla gorilla stretch in enclosure. A mother grooms her baby, brothers roll around, ooh, ahs. I search, spot him, silver back against the glass, leaning shoulder, looking out. Massive frame, big head, old sad eyes, large left hand pressed against the pane. I mirror him, press hand too, compare, it, ours, myself. Small frame, tiny head, same eyes. I think, ancestor, would you have picked up that tool if you knew? I think, brother, what we are and what we were, see no distance at all, and yet this pane of glass. Prose 2. So this story is on page 37. It's Fishing Men. I'm going to start a little bit after the beginning. Jack meets Arthur. Where's the fish? Arthur said as he opened the door. His gray brows rose, teeth tisked. If they were up your ass, you'd know. They laughed. shook hands, embraced. For a few minutes, they traded fuck yous and how are yous, because there was still some Jersey grit in their bones. An old friend of Jack's used to say it never goes away, just calcifies, and he died from a heart attack mid-cutoff on the turnpike. Always was a man of principle. Well, here we are, two dried-up Jersey boys, nothing we want working with nothing we want, Arthur finished, cracking an all-tooth smile. He was sharp for 88, quick-witted. Though he could no longer walk, restricted to a wheelchair several years earlier, Jack felt there was still great strength within him. Part of him still thought of the wheelchair as a long-standing practical joke. They poured whiskey and talked about family, about the lack thereof. Arthur's wife had died 20 years earlier. They never had any children. There was a time Jack wished for a child, even thought he would have one, but like his friend, he now lived alone. He had never married. When the room grew quiet, or their stories bore too much of that siren song nostalgia, the two played chess. A few feet from the kitchen and the living room, the two men sat in silence, the soft clacks of chess pieces echoing in the small apartment. On the walls were old sea charts and ship diagrams. Hand-carved wooden boats decorated the mantel. Smoke circled about the room and the men, the cigar propped in the ashtray to the left of the chessboard. For all the shit Jack liked to talk, Arthur hardly ever lost. If Jack won, it was usually because Arthur let him, though neither would ever admit it. They traded pieces and curses. The back and forth made them feel a little younger. Today, Arthur wasn't his usual self, had lost four games straight. He was quieter and seemed to consider each move very carefully, a strange showing of timidity. Jack knew something was off. I'm going to go forward a little bit. The next morning, he woke earlier than usual. He hadn't slept well, in part because he worried about Arthur. When your friend confuses you for his long-dead wife, it wasn't a good sign. He was old, though, 88. And what am I? Around him, his empty apartment answered, his left hand answered, the wrinkled face in the mirror answered. The jetty at sunrise was sparsely populated and quiet, so as the sun was cresting, Jack stood alone with more room for his thoughts and his line, set up his chair, and then grabbed the tackle box. His hands shook a bit as they baited the hook, and though it was early, even for an old fisherman, he reached into the cooler to the right of him and dug a small bottle of rum out from beneath the ice. He took a small sip to steady himself, lit a cigar, and placed the bottle back in the ice. And then a voice, curious and strong, asked, "Have you caught anything?" Jack turned, surprised. The voice he heard had sounded much older, but before him stood a small boy, barefoot and jean-clad, white shirt lazily buttoned. The boy stood several rocks away, fishing rod in hand, leaning forward in his questioning. The voice was confident, and the child's eyes were kind as they waited for an answer. "Not yet, kid." It was early, and the child seemed to be alone. Jack couldn't see any other figures. "Your parents know you're out here?" "I come and go as I please. I don't need permission." His tone was defiant, playful, and he moved closer to Jack as he spoke. "Old enough now, are you?" Jack thought he was 7, maybe 8. "Yes." It sounded sad, the way he said it. "Not sad," Jack decided, tired. "How long have you been a fisherman?" the boy asked, smiling, the voice glowing once again. "All my life." About them, the sun rose higher into the sky. A boat made its way out of the inlet, trailing flocks of seabirds eager for the catch. Jack started talking of his life as a fisherman. He talked for a long time, though he didn't know why. He told the boy about the years spent in the Arctic, how the salt spray could freeze before it hit your face, how the veterans would throw a live crab into each other's bunks to disturb the rarity of sleep. He told the child of the few unfortunate men who went over the rails, and he showed the boy his left hand. "I'd like to fish like that," the boy said, probing the useless digits with a peculiar reverence. "I'm tough, like you. You have to be tough to fish like that." Child's eyes were dark brown, near black, and there was a light within them that glinted as he spoke, a curious light like hot white flame. "You fish a lot," Jack said, still staring at his eyes. "Oh yes," the boy said, "always." Jack told the boy the best way to fish was to cast out, as if the line was not baited, as if there were no more fish and no chance of catching them. Hold the line, listen to the surf, and make peace with whatever bites. If in the end nothing does, well, change jobs or change your bait. Above them, the gulls quieted. Jack noticed the sun lowering, and he thought it strange that time could pass so quickly. He turned from the inlet to gaze at the stretch of beaches. Sand was aging gold in the last hours of sunlight, and the waters from that distance moved silent and sure, like bass beneath the surface before tails broke out into air. There was Jack and the boy and the sound of the sea wash repeating. He felt a small hand touch his own lightly as if to guide, and followed the prompting of that hand as it pointed to a vessel on the horizon. "Do you miss the sea?" the child asked. "Do you miss the salt spray in the open air and the unknown?" Jack said that yes, he did, and the child held out his hand. It was heavy there in the air, as if gravity itself bent towards it. Jack breathed once, grasped the child's open hand, and after a few heavy breaths found himself on the boat the boy had pointed out. They stood, staring at the jetty in the distance. There were others on the ship, at the railings, leaning at the bow, by the stern readying their lines. Each waved at him and some he knew. Closest to the stern was the greenhorn whose name Jack had forgotten. He He looked older, though not as old as Jack, and as he turned to face him, he waved a hand that should not have been there. Jack's right hand still held the boy's, and as he raised his left in answer, he found that every finger moved as it should, and he knew. It occurred to Jack he had never asked the boy's name. He didn't have to. It was written on his bones, and it was written in the air, and it was spoken by all things, and, especially, by silence. Jack flexed his fingers, watching them move. The air about him hummed its silence. "It's been a long time since I've stepped on a boat," he said, smiling. He felt lighter. "Do you think I could work the lines for a bit, before bunking up?" "Oh, yes," said the child, who was not a child. He spoke as he walked, angling towards the cabin door, and as he moved, Jack thought it was as if all light moved with him. Thanks.
Our penultimate reader will be Amanda Gaines. Everybody give it up for Amanda Gaines.
Hi, everyone. If I seem nervous, it's because I'm terrified of all of you. I'm not going to read my prose because it's long and I don't want to. Blooming. Cerulean acrylic hands, dirt-ringed toes, and sweat-soaked curls moved in unison, moved as my small but swift steps carried me across spring-soft grass. Warm air danced light between my limbs, carrying my father's voice with it. Across broad bridges and rolling knolls they travel, transfixed and fluid, wind and word, assuring me that my calloused palms, hill-worked heels and tangled curls moving in unison move with them. And when the strings of my hair rise with a balmy uptake, and when the backs of my calves feel the faint tickle of spring-soft grass, I hear my father's voice with it, reminding me of my weight. Thanks, guys.
And lastly, we have Travis Kent.
The wreck. Or wreck. I don't know. Silence. Do you hear it? The cabin of the pickup truck was full of it, as we carved the wheeling curves of a two-lane road. Black asphalt edged with a frame of white and zippered in the middle by dashed yellow, swept through green fields and brown woods. The hood of the truck and the sky alone were blue. We were alone. No one else haunted that road the way we did. I sat shotgun with the console between the driver and me. My brothers and father were strapped onto the back bench seat. But who was driving? I didn't know this kid. Or was it a man? Where did we come from? Where is he taking us? With a gentle lift from the accelerator, he set the truck for a wide, flat curve. Trees bordered both sides of us, dense forestry on one side and picketed on the left. The turn-in was smooth. He adjusted the radio knob, but it made no difference. Mid-corner, I glanced at the tachometer. The orange needle bounced up. The transmission kicked down. We felt it. The speedometer climbed, and I didn't question as it rose into triple digits. It kept climbing. Now all around us was green. We were gliding through a field. My father turned the page of a magazine. Ahead of us was white. My brother languidly gazed out the window. He let out a puff of cigarette smoke, which floated of its own volition, irreverent of the subtle swaying that had now begun. Ahead of us was white, a wedding reception. Bride and groom could not see us. The townsfolk were unaware. The truck tipped a little and then settled back. "Stay calm. Lean towards the center," someone said. Was it me? Did I dare disturb that noiselessness? Triple digits. It tipped again, and single-plane gravity became a distant memory as the centrifugal force of the spinning... to the centrifugal force of the spinning truck. We were inside an 8,000-pound, perfectly tossed football. The weightlessness seemed to go on for a long time. My dad turned another page. I settled my head toward the console. He adjusted the volume on the radio. No change. A crushing force made me feel my own weight again tenfold. Through the window I saw shards of blue flying into the blue and the green, but there was no white. Glass shattered, and I was refreshed by crisp air. Weightless again, my brother tossed his cigarette out the window frame. We all huddled in as the edges of the cab began to collapse. Now noise. The wind howling, and the crumpling, and clanking, and creaking, and smashing, tearing, ripping, bursting, and breathing. Another trip round, another bout of weightlessness, and then again. It happened so many times I began to wonder if this was the way life would always be, if this was the way life always had been. Moments of weightlessness, moments of exponential weightiness, and through all the loud destruction, calm silence. The truck had stopped. Blue above and green below, but no blue out front. Okay. The driver's door was open, and there was no driver. A rotund black suit, nice tie, waddled toward us with wedding guests in tow. I booted open my door. My family behind me did as well. I stood on the door sill and looked at the path we carved through the grass. Chunks of mangled blue were strewn about the green. My God, are you all alive? Nobody hurt? Bellowed the man. I looked at him. My head cocked to one side, and I wondered why this man was speaking.
Okay, so I have a confession. I lied to you. Marian said I should read, so I'm going to do what the professor says. I'll read you a poem. The only one I think that's worth reading of mine, but you know, beside the point, I've just grown very indifferent towards the memories that are attached to the other one. So this poem is an elegy for a friend named Paul Stover. He died like 2 years ago, I think. He was a WVU student. And one of the most wild and wonderful people that I've ever met. So yeah, take that for what it's worth, I guess. This is called Remembering Paul. Tonight, the sky expresses nothing vastly. Cricket song back, overwhelming. The Morgan Street sign turns its face away. At the corner, old shoes asphyxiate themselves on wires taut between telephone poles. Hang up. Options. Delete. Delete. I cry, quiet as clouds. Night breeze, please. Give the wind chime a little breath when I lose the will to sing.